What's up, Michelle?
Hey Cedric, how are you?
I'm great.
It's
Happy Tuesday.
good to see you.
Likewise, it's been a couple weeks.
Yes, it is. I'm sure you had fun with Paul last week, but I'm always glad to join
Yeah,
you.
of course. Well, this is Bitcoin.
Brought to you by Bite Federal.
On.
We got audio going on. Bitcoin Center is brought to you by Bite Federal. Go bank yourself. Check out, we've got two wallets in the App Store, Bite Vault, which is a non-custodial bank, non-custodial app, hold your own keys, and Bite Wallet, which is our new digital on-ramp. And of course, we've got ATMs nationwide. If you are still holding cash, we are doing our best to keep the cash economy alive. And the governments do not like it because they can't track your cash as well as they would like to. We got you
And they
back,
try.
Cedric?
Yeah,
Oh,
my
they
bad.
are.
Can you hear me okay now?
Yeah.
A little technical difficulties there, but the big news over the weekend was Mexico, huh?
Oh, yeah, it's crazy. Crazy stuff going on down there. I was just trying to catch up on that this weekend. What do you think of it? Do you think it's another like Venezuela situation where we should not be involved? Do you think Trump should send forces down and help him out? What do you think is the right play?
Well, obviously, I mean, I don't know what the right play is, but it seems like it's a global coordinated effort at this point. And in a lot of ways, I see a lot of good things happening with some of these moves. It
Like a
what I'm
global
reading
effort to get rid of some of the tyrannical.
trafficking networks. And I don't know if it's for show or it's really happening. And supposedly this particular network wasn't just drugs. It was, I think, the number one sort of trafficker of fentanyl, it appears.
I
It's hard
saw
to know
that.
where
I
it's really
didn't.
true, but.
No, I saw that it was like number one by a wide margin, the fentanyl tracker coming from Mexico. And I know that there was a lot of that discussed when all the stuff was happening in Venezuela. And of course, you know, it's something I think whatever, but I do hope, I haven't seen anything really about like trafficking of people. I hope that they
I've
are
heard
working on
some of that.
shutting those routes down as
Well, I've heard
well.
that this is a large network of human trafficking as well. There's speculation, right? And then it's really who is taking down who, or is it sort of people making deals behind the scenes? Is he the real leader, or was he retired and there was already a new leader? Is there actually a power vacuum right now? Is the unrest and violence in Mexico between the government and this particular cartel, or is it between the other cartels trying to jump in for power? Is it both? There's just so many question marks. What I also find interesting, I mean, this is different than Venezuela in that there's doesn't seem like maybe a as strong a partnership for the a stronger political entity for the government, U.S. government to work with here if they did want to sort of handle it like Venezuela. It's
And
I think it's Yeah.
you have a fair amount of American tourists, well, tourists from all over, but certainly American tourists who are stuck there. So I think that's interesting. You know, we'll see if it turns out to be like a temporary situation, or if, in my opinion, there may be this global trend growing where there are less and less places that are super safe to go. You know, I think there's been a lot of geopolitical unrest and you know, you may not want to like jump down to Mexico for a long weekend.
I don't. I think I didn't mean to say I don't want to. I mean, I don't think a lot of people are going to want to do that as much as they used to. And I think there was even, I've seen talk online how a lot of Canadians maybe were skipping going to southern United States or Florida and maybe went to
Oh,
Mexico this
really?
year. Yeah. And yeah, I think it's sort of showing how we're retreating from globalization. What I find really interesting, though, is that I've read that Mexico is the number one producer for silver mines or silver mining.
Oh, I don't think I knew that. That's an interesting factor.
Yeah, that's an interesting tangent. And sort of, I guess you could speculate on what maybe ulterior motives are there or how that sort of plays into this. And they didn't capture him alive.
No, they did not.
Kind of murky. He dies in transport, I guess. And I think his stepson is from California. And there's speculation that his stepson is taking over the organization. I think he was in charge of sort of the military.
Okay.
And there was already a $5 million bounty on his head.
Right. And that's really, you know, one of the biggest problems with these cartels is there's always, you cut off the snake's head and there's always one ready to step in. So I think, you know, you look at things like what happened in El Salvador, and a lot of people don't like the sort of looks of what happened down there. But in many ways, it's kind of the only way to deal with the infestation of the cartels or, you know, these groups is you've got to take them all out, or I don't know how effective, the efforts are really going to end be.
How do you go about that from outside if the cartels maybe own the government already? And, so maybe there's very little separation between the government and the cartels. And so who does America partner with on something like that?
Right. Or should we,
Should we, should the international community do that? And so I don't know. This seems like it seems very different than Venezuela in the sense that, do you think that these things affect like the price of Bitcoin?
I think that they do to some extent because I think you've only got a certain percentage of holders that have been in long enough that they're really, really convicted, and world events and markets up and down have absolutely no effect on them. But by and large, most people, especially people that are maybe newer to Bitcoin, don't understand it that well, they are greatly affected by market movements, geopolitical factors, and Bitcoin's super easy to liquidate. And so it's one of the first things that people start to sell when they get nervous. So I think it definitely has a bit of a price, maybe not major, but certainly some effect on price.
I mean, there's always been the notion that Bitcoin is a canary in the coal mine. You know, the world is volatile, Bitcoin price is not. And the volatility you see in the Bitcoin exchange rate is the volatility in the world. And there were definitely certain events.
And it's sort of like a leading indicator.
Maybe a leading indicator or in real time. So March 9th, 2020, with COVID, Bitcoin crashed along with everything else. Maybe crashed more even. And you could look at certain events. I think it was around one instance with Iran where I think Bitcoin dropped a bit. And people would say, oh, Bitcoin's sniffing this out. You know, has maybe this deterioration in Bitcoin price been related to all this uncertainty in the world? And sort of fracturing. Or is this sort of just, normal? Like, do you think that this first year of Trump's term, second term, with Venezuela, the comments on Greenland, Canada, is more dramatic, going to be more dramatic in hindsight, historically speaking, than other first years of other terms in recent memory? Or is this just par for the course? And, in 30 years ago in Nicaragua, we took down a leader there. I mean,
I think largely it depends what happens next, because I think there's a good chance that the Republicans are slaughtered in the midterms. And if they impeach Trump again, history is always written like in retrospect and by the victors. And so it will largely, in my opinion, depend on what plays out over the next few years. I think sentiment is low for Trump. There's half the country thinks that he's this crazy authoritarian lunatic. Half the country thinks he's not nearly authoritarian enough and that he's not living up to his promises. And of course, we have all these other events, that you're kind of asking about. I think it's probably too soon to say how people will look back, and that it will end on what happens later this year and then even in 2028.
So do you think that If you said you started off with the Republicans might lose the midterms, and I try not to follow, you know, politics too closely, but you would think that would not be the goal of the Trump administration, or any administration would want to sort of stay in power or sort of keep, you know, win the midterm so they're not a lame duck.
Right.
And so do you think, so then do you think that they are on course to lose the midterms? Do you think sentiment is down? So I think it was a fair assessment. Yes. Like some people are, you know, think he's not authoritarian enough. Some people think he's too authoritarian. Those sound like the, right. the voting part, people who vote. Do you think that he would lose the vote right now, or the Republicans would lose? And then would it be, like, I'm trying to figure out their political calculation.
I think they are going to lose.
Right. So then would the moves they've made over the last 14 months be worth it if they're on a trajectory to lose? And then I wonder why they chose to pursue what they have instead of maybe securing, you know, more
goodwill
at home, however you would put it. I mean, it doesn't seem like sentiment's great in the United States for domestic policy. Right.
Yeah, I think in my opinion, Trump's biggest like downfall is that he is too willing to negotiate. He's like this famous negotiator, and he also is too willing. He still has too much trust in historical systems. And so I'm on the side that thinks he's not gone far enough. And, you know, people by and large voted for mass deportations. And if you turn on the legacy news, they're bragging about like the border being secure and all these deportations. But if you actually look at the numbers, I mean, it really, really, it's not that much that's being done. You know, you've seen protests and stuff like that, but we're not getting the mass deportations that people voted for. I think that's got a lot of people unhappy. In my opinion, he is like making moves geopolitically. He's making the big moves up front in case he does lose the midterms and become a lame duck. You know, there's rumors that he's confused about why people are unhappy. And I think that that, again, just kind of goes back to the fact that he has too much trust in the legacy system, and he doesn't understand that people really, really want very serious accountability that he's not providing. Like, you know, we don't care about these little wins or the fake paper economy. We want the entire Epstein list in jail. We want mass deportations. And of course the other side wants, I don't know what the other side wants, but I guess that's my take on it.
Do you think we're in a place in this country where like no matter who's in power from either party, they would just not be happiness overall because it's just sort of digressed so much?
I do believe that. I think we've become so divided and so split and so far apart too. You know, even in real life, I think people are struggling more and more to like get along because everyone is just like canonized on one side or the other. And I'm a huge advocate for like abolishing that and bringing back, like, let's not talk about politics. Let's be friends with everybody. But I don't see, that's not the direction we're going. I mean, I think we're going in the direction that leads to balkanization one day. Lock them all up. That's right.
What do you mean lock them all up?
Sorry, somebody commented.
Oh, there was a comment there. I was like, well, you know, it does seem like balkanization. It seems like nobody wants to kind of, I shouldn't say nobody. It appears that it's hard to get sort of consensus even on what's going on or how to measure success. So I try to not root for a particular party. Try to just stick to the issues and be objective. I do try to sort of notice trends. So at the beginning of the year, like I'm looking at the Dow Jones Industrial Average, and I mean, over the last 12 months, it's up a lot. And I remember
keep hearing that.
Maybe some
people. I couldn't care less, Cedric.
Right, or maybe Bitcoiners don't care as much, right? But the factoid that I remember at the beginning of the year when tariffs were were being rolled out, and there was just a lot of it was uncertain, and there was a lot of instability. And I mean, I do think there's a war on small business since COVID.
Yeah.
And even really since online, and the way online has been sort of rolled out and regulated. So there's this war on small business, and the tariffs were probably really hard on small businesses.
No doubt.
But I do remember a lot of people who were sort of anti-Trump and other people as well, but like the Dow was going down. The Dow was at its lowest over the last 12 months. When Trump came into office, it was probably 43,000, 44,000, went down into the high 38,000, high 30,000s. And a lot of people who I remember who would not measure the economy by the Dow, because they would say the Dow is for rich people, the Dow is for the elite 1%, all of a sudden were measuring the economy in the Dow and saying, hey, Trump's tariffs are hurting 401ks and retirement plans.
It was really a talking point.
It was really a talking point. But now the Dow is near 50,000 and it's not a talking point in the sort
they
of
want
the
it to be.
Well, I mean, the Trump administration would like it to be. I don't blame them, but just in my mind, I remember growing up, Dow 30 was a big number. Is Dow ever going to 30,000? I mean, this is almost 50,000 Dow, and I think it's crossed at some point and I don't think the Dow is the best way to measure the economy either. But traditionally, this would be something mainstream Americans would be excited about.
It really represents the absolute collapse in faith among regular people for these traditional systems. Because historically, yes, this would be big news. You know, famously, a couple weeks ago, you had Pam Bondi in some DOJ hearing, you know, asked explicitly about accountability for the Epstein files. And she brings this up. She brings up the Dow and how fantastic the economy is doing. And it was really, really like this moment in time of absurdity because... But I think in many ways it represents the shift in narrative and what people want and care about. I think a lot of people, more and more people are being priced out of being invested in anything. And so they don't care. Yeah. So that this concept of it being like for the 1%, I think is only growing. The gap is only widening. And even people that maybe have small investments or they have a 401k or something like this, they just don't care because they know that it's all fake bullshit nonsense, you know, okay, great. The number on the screen is going up, but like, is my life better? No. Is my life more affordable? No. Is life for my children going to be better? No. Like, these are the things that people really care about. And that number is supposed to represent all of that in aggregate, but it no longer does. So like, why care?
The other numbers I'm trying to look at, I haven't dug too deep, but the stats I've come across that deportations seem to be down from prior administrations in total per day.
Yes.
But we're seeing, I personally, and I think most of us have seen some cases on the news not a large sample set. I haven't seen, but I've seen some things on the news. And what I think what's been hard is the notion that like there aren't uniforms and they're masks. Because
ICE in.
So what I'm trying to figure out, if there are less deportations, are they being done differently?
It's just more propaganda.
I don't know. That's what I'm trying to figure out. I don't know.
Sure.
And I'm not saying you're wrong either. And then what I'm trying to figure out, I'm not saying I'm putting all my time into this, but like, I think like when I come across these events, it's like, is that propaganda? What are the numbers? Okay, the numbers are down. But that doesn't mean that tactics haven't changed. Like, just because I think that's propaganda doesn't mean that they are doing it the same way. But I've seen no evidence that they've changed tactics or methodology. But I know my community was in an uproar about the idea of ICE coming into the schools. And, you know, it's a weird debate because if any law enforcement's already allowed into the schools. So, it would be like saying, no, we don't want the police to come in, or no, we don't want whatever. So,
can I ask you a question?
Yeah, sure.
The uproar about ICE coming in, was that all theoretical or did ICE actually show up?
It was theoretical.
Of course.
Well, okay. So this was, you know the community. But like, So one of the leaders on the board of education, I forget what it's called. I think not the board of education, but the on the board of the
yeah, the of board the, of the that governs the school. Yeah.
Yeah. And he, one member of the board, there's like five people on the board, went to like a anti-ICE rally.
Right.
So the leader of the board wanted a pro-ICE resolution or amendment passed.
Okay.
And then so it kind of backfired on the leader because it's already legal for ICE to come into the school or any law enforcement right. agency. Right. But right. the community then said, if we're having a vote, we overwhelmingly, I mean, I'm not saying but the community sure. came out overwhelmingly and did say, yeah, we actually want to vote no, ICE can't come into the school.
Okay.
So but, you know, it backfired in terms of sentiment, right?
Right.
And so now they're debating breaking the law, but it did make me think about, like, what does it mean for any agency to come into the school and grab a kid, let's say, or a teacher?
Sure.
And now you say, okay, maybe that kid or teacher is a criminal, right? So again, that's okay. We get criminals wherever they are. Do we have to get them at school? Maybe not. In front of kids who are innocent, maybe not. We can debate that. But then right. who is allowed to come to school and what makes a lawful entry? So you would think clear declaration of who we are and a warrant or something, right? So there's a lot of debate about what sure. it takes to sure. then enter the school, even legally. And I think that's a good conversation to be had. And I think, you know, I wouldn't want masked people to come into the school without documentation. I'm not okay with that. I'm not saying that's what would happen, but that seemed to be what the propaganda was right. saying might happen or whatever.
Well, I think it's all propaganda because, I mean, look at this small example in our little community here, right? And the reason I ask, like, is this really happening or is this propaganda is because I'm familiar with the local community. Like we follow the laws. We have sheriffs. They're great. Like, I don't think that there are huge problems here. And it's really this, like, the divide and conquer. And this is a fantastic example of what we touched on earlier about how I don't think the people are coming back together. Because why are we even arguing about ICE and can they right. come in school or not? Because right. it's not, like, it's not a huge thing here, right? Like, if we have criminals in the community, they're going to be gotten. And nobody's storming the schools. Like...
Right. Well, so, let's have common sense. Right. But at the same time, the community said, hey, we would prefer not to abide by the rules. So
right.
my point is, and whether you agree or disagree, my point is you don't always get good outcomes with democracy.
I agree with that.
And maybe that's because not everyone cares and votes. Maybe not a fair representation of the community came out and voted. But the people who did vote, people who did make a say, overwhelmingly said we would like to not let the law enforcement agencies into the schools. Which is a different debate, though, than I think, and maybe this is their point, though, is like we'd prefer, you know, not to have you come and do your business in the school, even though it's lawful and legal, because we prefer you in the parking lot or at the theater or, but again, and then that's maybe a different, I mean, why would you prefer it happens over here and not there? I mean, at least that would be a conversation, right? And I think that's a good...
Sure.
I mean, I think country would be great. Well, one, I think we need to do things less nationally and more at the local Agreed. Level. And I think it'd be good Absolutely. To have more conversations at the local level.
I agree with that.
My main point about deportations, but we got kind of sidetracked a bit, I guess in a good way, but was it strategic? Let's say even tactics changed. But are these things intertwined where the United States government didn't want to help the Mexican authorities go in and get this particular cartel leader because they were afraid that there were terror cells in the United States? And or is that propaganda that all these people who might have crossed the border are here to do violence and damage on, you know, first notice from their home countries? And home networks.
Well, you know that I think most things are propaganda, but I don't think that it's propaganda that people illegally invading your country, especially men of a fighting age, that, and we've seen very large numbers of those. You know, it's not these like sad families with crying babies. Like, by and large, there are men of fighting age coming, and to think that they are not loyal to their home countries is obscene. Like, they're waving flags of their home countries in our streets. So
are you surprised? I mean, I lived in New York City after 9/11. There were a lot of talk about, you know, there was going to be terrorist attacks every day in New York City after 9/11, with some speculation that there'd be a wave of terror. And that seemed to be propaganda, too, that I'm just saying, it's did they successfully get all the bad guys before they went into Mexico? Are they worried about some people in the United States still? Like, it's hard to know what's true. What's really happening and who's on what side and how it's all linked
together.
That's
for sure.
So
yeah, there's no doubt about that. And it's just going to get more and more complicated. So like you said, I think the more that people focus on their local communities, the better, because even if our local communities are a bit crazy, the world is getting crazier. So.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's get into the show. We'll roll the intro and get into it. Thank you for joining Bitcoin Center, brought to you by Byte Federal.
Let's be real, right? Praising Telegram for launching a Bitcoin wallet. I've always felt like Vitalik.
Bitcoin, this digital currency that's out there that people say, oh, it might be the next big thing. What do you think?
I think it's rat poison.
Bitcoin. You never heard of them a few weeks ago? Now everybody's talking about them, but is it a currency?
I don't know. Or is it more like a stock? Or is it a tulip bulb?
Or is it just
debate that?
Stupid.
To me, it smells like Ponzi scheme and the greater fool theory, right?
If you do like 5 minutes of freaking research.
Well, good. Thanks for coming to my set talk.
Yes.
Don't buy Bitcoin.
Oh, man, I didn't get that wrong. All right.
Bitcoin's recent rally.
Do you agree? Is crypto finally dead? Go to the next one.
Matter of fact, they're kind of in the Ethernet. What are they?
There's some rumors that it's this Japanese guy, but others say no, that he's a fake name. It was a pseudonym.
You're literally putting real money onto a system that we don't even know who created it.
It will come to a bad ending.
Is this the most exciting bull run ever?
Not for me. No, it's not.
Welcome to Bitcoin Center, the fast-paced show where the debate is the story.
Bitcoin Center number 42, brought to you by Byte Federal. Go bank yourself. David Bailey, back in the news, faces self-dealing allegations after the Nakamoto collapse. What do you think, Michelle?
This is a mess.
Yeah, tell me more. Don't hold me.
Yeah, look, I mean, I don't want to be too nice about it, but I think it's too early to be like too ruthless. Public markets are a whole thing, something that I like am not a big fan of. Like to me, the reason I'm in Bitcoin is because I don't want anything to do with this nonsense. But you know, people are upset. Like, obviously, you have the price being way down. And then the most recent news with the acquisition, I think those are very separate conversations, because the acquisition is something that they've been talking about for quite a while. Like, I think a lot of people bought into Naka because there was like rumors that they were going to acquire.
Yeah, Bitcoin, that was laid out in advance.
That was right.
You still don't have to execute the option, you know, at the detriment of your shareholders. You could hold off, I guess. I mean, things obviously haven't gone the way I think he had hoped, David.
Right.
I listened to him.
Price is down. Yeah. 99%
price is down.
That's not good.
Every which way you could have played this, I think, has not gone well and been played poorly.
Here's my question. Is it too big to fail. Like, there's so much money invested in this thing. I mean, they raised almost $1 billion.
Why would it be too big to fail? I think they actually would, if it fails, the creditors get the coins at a discount. The insiders is win-win here either way. And
if they get delisted.
If they get delisted, well, they continue to lose value and someone's going to buy the assets at a discount. They're sitting on, I'll pull
like 7,000.
I think it's less now, but maybe 5,000, 6,000, or 7,000 Bitcoin. Yeah. Which is worth maybe probably what, 400 million, 500 million today. And if you could buy them for 200 million.
Right.
And I think the creditors already is right now is cracking at about 8% loan.
Okay.
They wheeled and dealed themselves a bunch of losses just borrowing and then renegotiating terms on loans.
Right. Well, you know a lot more about, you know, the TradFi markets and people going public and stuff like that. So what do you think? Do you think they saved themselves or is this done?
Well, I think there are more parachutes here for them to save themselves. I think as long as they can get their stock price up to above $1 before June, they'll stay on NASDAQ. Right. They have a shelf registration to sell another $5 billion in equity at the market so they can still raise more money potentially. And they have the coin. So the value of Bitcoin could save them going up. They have,
if it goes down,
more time on their side. I mean, each move they've made has been to buy time, but all of it at the expense of the shareholders.
Right.
And even insiders aren't that up, or a lot of insiders are down because a lot of insiders got in at $1.12.
Yeah.
29 cents. So.
Right.
It's
not good. Burned.
So then.
I have to be honest, like I don't want to root against anybody in the Bitcoin industry. Like, I'm not hoping that they get delisted. I hope that they can save themselves. But it's definitely not good. And it would be, I mean, we kind of been waiting for some sort of black swan, and I don't know if that would be a black swan of this cycle, or, you know, do we even have cycles anymore? It wouldn't be good. You know, I don't think I understand why people are upset if you put a lot of money into this thing. But I don't think anybody should be necessarily rooting against them. Like, or maybe we want to burn it all down. I don't
know. Well, yeah, I mean, that's the idea behind Bitcoin is to not get yourself exposed to these kinds of things, risks you can't control.
Exactly.
That doesn't have to be 100% Bitcoin. Doesn't mean that you can't be in any securities, but the more you're exposed to these kinds of things, I think it's also good to think about sort of Bitstein, Michael Goldstein's legendary article, "Everyone is a Scammer." Everyone wants your Bitcoin, and it can happen from every angle. And it doesn't have to be David Bailey who ends up with the Bitcoin through Nakamoto, but you might lose yours. That Bitcoin might end up with Kraken. Maybe David Bailey's a shareholder of Kraken. Right, you don't know how the deal is structured and how the Wizard of Oz in Wall Street is making money off this collapse in so many different ways, and who's in
but
on
they
and
are.
Who's not. But they are, and that's the whole point of Bitcoin, is not to expose yourself to that or limit your exposure to that. And so then you see all these Bitcoiners, and I use that term loosely here, Bitcoiners. Doing these things, and, you know, just like anything else, but specifically things that are speculative in nature or related to money or asset appreciation tend to draw good and bad people, and sometimes more bad people than good. It's there's this idea that everyone in Bitcoin is just everyone's good. They're Bitcoin. And that doesn't mean, I'm not talking about, I think there's increased odds of meeting good people. And I think good people are drawn to Bitcoin. But I think also there are a lot of really bad people who are drawn to Bitcoin, not because of Bitcoin's ethos, but because of the opportunity to Affinity Scam and be associated with this thing that tends to go up in value a lot over long periods of time, and to catch that wave and to grift off it. And it's absolutely very hard to tell the difference between the two. And if you're is just sort of going to a pleb and talking about, like, you know, getting educated or learning things or hanging out and connecting, you tend not to really interact too much with the sharks. But you if you want to buy securities and you want to collateralize your Bitcoin, and I'm not saying you can't do these things, but this is where you're going to start interacting with a much higher ratio of scammers.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree with that more. It doesn't mean
they're all scammers, but, you know, just keep your head on the swivel.
If people are encouraging you to do something with your hard-earned money other than just, like, buying Bitcoin and holding it over a long-term period, look at their incentives, right? Because they're probably trying to make money, more money for themselves. And I couldn't agree with you more, Cedric. The deeper into these, like, fiat games that you get, and for me, all this Wall Street stuff is all fiat games, the deeper into that you get, the higher percentage of people who do not have your best interest in mind, you know, you're going to find a higher percentage of people who just are trying to take your money.
Yeah, and get theirs. And just so,
yeah,
buyer beware. Just like everything else, you know, and sort of Bitcoin's best way. Bitcoin in self-custody is the best That's way right. to defend yourself against that. And you can go to Byte Federal ATMs and get your Bitcoin and bank yourself.
We're trying to keep cash alive.
This next one's really interesting to me. This Eric Trump clip, if we can get that rolling.
Well, too, you know, I know stablecoin is different than Bitcoin, but you've been big proponents and bullish on Bitcoin as well.
We still are. I'm a huge proponent of Bitcoin. I do think it hits $1 million. I think it's one of the greatest performing asset classes. I mean, go back 2 years. Bitcoin was at, what, 16,000? You know, where is it at right now? 70?
Yeah.
Right? I mean, if you look at the last 10 years, Bitcoin has gone up 70% a year on average, year over year for the last decade. Name an asset class that has performed better than Bitcoin. And now, obviously, you have lots of volatility. If you don't want volatility, you know, go invest in some muni. You know, go have a great time. Go invest in some treasury. You're going to have volatility with something that has tremendous upside. But I've never been more bullish on Bitcoin in my life. I've never been more bullish on cryptocurrency in my life. You look at what every one of the big financial institutions in the country is doing, whether it be Fidelity, whether it be Charles Schwab, whether it be JP Morgan, whether it be BlackRock, right? Goldman's here. Yeah, I mean, go down the list. Every single one of them are adopting cryptocurrencies. They're willing to treasury cryptocurrencies. They're putting their private wealth clients into cryptocurrencies. Before, they were telling them to put exactly zero into cryptocurrency. Then it was 2%. Now, all of a sudden, it's 5, 6%, and that number keeps on climbing. It is the asset class of this generation. It's what every person under the age of 50 is into and loves, and we're just getting started.
Yeah. I mean, I think he's very well spoken on Bitcoin, very bullish. I think something interesting to note, I didn't realize, because there was that picture of Saylor at the Trump event a few weeks ago. Mm-hmm. Saylor was kind of in the background. And there was somewhere noted that Eric Trump has said that he's been friends with Saylor for about 20 years.
Yeah, they've been friends for a really long time. The Trumps did, you know, they're based in New York, and, you know, I mean, full disclosure, I know Eric really well. And I actually knew Saylor back in the day in DC. And Eric and, I mean, the Trump family and Saylor have, in fact, been friends for a very long time. So I think, you know, the Trumps are well informed on Bitcoin. I think Eric Trump is the one that is a true Bitcoiner. You know, the rest of his family may be playing around with some of these other, you know, they did the coins and whatever, but Trump will put his name on anything. But I think that's just noise, and that the real signal is the Bitcoiner in the family, which is Eric. And I think, you know, everything that he has said in this interview is dead on. I mean, I don't disagree with anything that he's said there.
Do you think Eric Trump was into Bitcoin before Saylor was publicly? Like, meaning Saylor publicly came out into Bitcoin in 2020? No.
No, they're newer. Because when I first got into Bitcoin, it was the debanking that got them. Before I was even on Twitter, I was trying to start, I was going to do my own podcast and talk to people that were not in Bitcoin. And Eric was one of the people that I was trying to get to talk to me. I had some friends that were like trading commodities and some friends in DC that worked with like FDIC. And I was like having all these conversations with these people. And I was like, this would be a really interesting podcast. And that didn't work out. But he's newer, but he knows that Saylor has been in and how deep Saylor's been in. And I think that that holds a lot of credibility. And then of course the debanking is a huge factor in terms of like how quickly he was orange pilled, I would say.
Right. Wow. All right. Well, let's move on to the lightning round here. Adam Back is, you know, been all over the Bitcoin news. Andy might have went down to Epstein Island. I don't think he's really spoken about that.
I don't think he has.
Really sort of acknowledged that. I think that there's more to this still, in terms of who knew what and who was where. And the one thing I just can't get over is about, how nobody involved, there's not one who I've seen, and that doesn't mean it doesn't exist, but that kind of came out and preemptively before their name was ever in a file and just said, hey, you know, I was roped into something and I was down. And I met him in 2015 and then, you know, and get out in front of it. I mean, and I would see that as more authentic. Whereas if something happened 10 or 12 years ago and you met Jeffrey Epstein or was invited to even, and you never bring that up and he, you know, the memes about Jeffrey Epstein or so, I would preempt that if I ever thought, and because the notion, like you see Howard Lutnick going through this where, you know, he's publicly said, I only met him once. And then the evidence just keeps coming out. And you're just, it's way worse. If it was true that you only met them once, in his case, it wouldn't have been true. But let's say there was somebody in this orbit who only actually met Jeffrey Epstein once and then actually. So I don't know. I mean, he hasn't commented on that. He's doing work here with Lutnick. Lutnick's son.
Slayer Heroes.
Yeah.
That's how I feel about Adam Back right now.
Which is a Bitcoin thing to do. I mean,
it is.
My personal thing is like not really to have heroes. I don't think it's good, really. Like your mom and your dad.
I agree with that.
Your heroes. Right. That doesn't mean they're perfect people, but like maybe, you know, they got it together enough to get you across the line with your flaws or not, you know, or whatever trials and tribulations you went through. But the notion of having heroes, I don't think is very mature.
I could agree with that.
You know, I think there's the whole, I think it's hard not to outsource some things in your life, even maybe like, and I think about Bitcoin, like you're like, you can't go down the rabbit hole in everything at once. You can't know everything about cryptography in your first year of Bitcoin. And maybe that first year you learn about monetary policy instead of cryptography. And the second year you learn, so there are people that I think you might look to say, like, what do they think about something? That doesn't make, just because you tend to agree with them or that they have great ideas, like, they shouldn't be your heroes.
Yeah, and also, like, a lot of these, like, sectors or facets of Bitcoin are not interoperable, right? So just because Adam Back was a cypherpunk hero and kind of like a legend in the cryptography space, it doesn't mean that we should be following him for macro expertise or that everything he's doing is on the up and up or that just because his name is attached to this BSTR, that makes it a positive thing. Like,
yeah, you bring up the macro trade. I mean, but I think he's a trader. I think he's
traded pre
Bitcoin. That might lend itself from the math skills that go into cryptography, but it is interesting. And I'm just trying to note what we see. You know, I've met Andy once. I've had him on the show once. He's very nice. But spread very thin like Elon Musk. I question that. You know, he's involved in a lot of treasury companies. He runs Blockstream. He's advisor to a lot of Bitcoin companies. He attends a lot of events. It's just a lot to... He's on Twitter all the time.
I was going to say, running his Twitter account.
And And I was also trying to figure out why are Bitcoiners, maybe Bitcoiners with low cost basis, why would they be incentivized to do these in-kind transactions with these treasury companies? I mean, Adam Beck has now done tens of thousands, not given is not the right word, but you're essentially selling.
Traded. It's a good question, Cedric.
And so like, now I think you're that's a very good gains tax. You could borrow against maybe the securities that you're receiving, but maybe you like leverage and you want to be move your Bitcoin into a product that you can leverage. I mean, none of these things sound very Bitcoin. You lose custodial rights. You don't get tax advantages that I could see. So I'm not sure what the major incentive is to be so involved in these Bitcoin treasury companies to even fund them with your own Bitcoin, especially if you're paying capital gains tax upon doing so. I guess slay your heroes.
Lots of questions, not a lot of answers.
No, not on this one. We got another clip here. But before we do, I do want to talk about I think there's also a cycle to the year in sort of the Bitcoin ecosphere or the marketing sphere around like look at the conference. If you look at the Bitcoin conference in Vegas, we saw this last year. A lot of these treasury companies, and I'm not including Strategy here, not including Strategy and Metaplanet, even though Metaplanet is very close to the Bitcoin orbit. A lot of the treasury companies were formed in last winter and spring, and then you use the Bitcoin conference as your great big marketing vehicle. You hope to catch some wind at your sales with Bitcoin price. If there is euphoria from that frenzy that you get to whip up about your own treasury companies, and you get that premium, that MNAV up, you can dump on retail, even a bit, it's sort of like the CNBC effect where people with large positions go on to CB. They don't reveal their position, but they say, you should buy this stock. This is going to go to the moon. And they're the ones selling and they need liquidity. And they don't want to sell to nobody. And they do. And so you're getting like, they're using it in a manipulative way, that platform, potentially.
Yeah, I think these treasury companies, I mean, there's a strong case and a fantastic place for Bitcoin on the books of operating revenue-generating companies. But this whole treasury play, especially with no revenue, I think that is just this cycle's crypto. I mean,
so I think there's less, I agree with you, there's less trapped capital, I think, in the system. I'm not sure how much is trapped, but will there be a day where there's like there are gold mining companies, and they're playing on the speculative appreciation of gold as well as their ability to find gold more efficiently than their competitors. And there's a whole speculative nature.
Like Bitcoin.
So will Bitcoin treasury companies become, in essence, like Bitcoin mining companies without the hash power?
No.
So they become
I think it's a fad. I think it's a bubble. I think the Bitcoin treasury companies that will be really valuable in the future, aside from MSTR, maybe Metaplanet, because they had a huge head start, nobody's catching up. But aside from them, like if you don't have an underlying business, like what are you doing?
You're betting on the appreciation of Bitcoin. And
sure, but
From the financial mind, I mean, you're like, wow, I can borrow at 10%, buy this thing that's going to go up at 30% and skim the difference.
But I think people are going to wake up to this.
It's like if you own a hedge fund and your market deal is, your structure is 2 and 20. So you get,
I don't know 2%. What that means.
Okay. So if you have a $100 million hedge fund, you raise $100 million, whether you raise that from one investor or 100 investors or 1,000 investors,
okay,
you have $100 million in your fund and you charge 2 and 20. So your first two, the first, you get 2% of the $100 million at the end of the year.
Okay.
So you make $2 million just by running the fund. If the fund goes down to 90 million, you get 1.9, you get it, right? And you get 20% of the profits.
Okay.
So you're incentivized to take the hedge fund punt to make a $95 million bet on some very speculative investment, if you double, you get 20%. You're going to get 4 million next year. If you take that fund from 100 million to 200 million, you get 4 million in fees, the 2%, and you get 20% of the $100 million profit. So you get a $24 million payout.
Okay, but now, here's what I don't understand.
If the bet goes south and you go down to like 50 million, you lose 50% of your investors' money, you make $1 million still.
Right. Yeah, so the game is rigged,
rigged against your investors in a way. You're incentivized to go for it all. Now, if you want to make the 2 million every year, you're not going to be too risky with it. And you're going to grow it enough for them to not all pull out. And yeah, maybe. But the point is, a lot of hedge funders are like, let's go for broke.
Yeah, but here's my question. What are you betting on? So if you want to go for broke, put it all in Bitcoin, right? Or go for
borrow other people's money and put it all in Bitcoin. But if the price moves against you, you still got in early against your investors. And if the price goes with you, everyone thinks you're a genius and everyone makes a lot of money.
You can either buy the underlying asset or you can buy the ETF. But why are you investing in a company that does nothing but hold Bitcoin, which you could do yourself? I genuinely don't understand the play.
I think the play is this. I think the play is the Bitcoiner being the someone who calls themselves a Bitcoiner and listens to Bitcoin content says, I know about BSTR before retail does. And when Bitcoin is at 60K. So I'll buy my shares now. And at some point, there'll be a Robinhood euphoria. And I'll dump on the retail coming to
I hear what you're saying. I don't think it's going to happen. I think retail's exhausted.
I'm not saying that's what I think is going to happen. I'm saying that's what people want.
That's the thesis.
Right.
We got an interesting clip here we can play.
Let's do it.
What do you think the role is of the Bitcoin treasury companies and sort of the burgeoning area in terms of how many have come onto the market recently and the decline in Bitcoin prices? Is there any correlation? It seems like that element of the story is a little bit different in terms of the decline that we're seeing this time around.
I think they are generally supportive for the Bitcoin price because for the most part, they try to hold, buy and accumulate as MicroStrategy started some years ago now. And so they're effectively taking Bitcoin off the market. They're generally able to do that in more bullish environments faster. But, you know, even today, they're buying Bitcoin.
But even with all these treasury companies buying Bitcoin, you have these holders. It should theoretically provide much more of a floor. Do you think that it does provide more of a floor for Bitcoin as we see prices decline?
I think Bitcoin tends to be a little weak to the downside because many of the retail investors end up being all in, and so they don't have a lot of capital to buy Bitcoin. Whereas if you look at public company stocks or big mutual funds looking at analyst reports, if they see the price of something come down, you know, they might sell some Microsoft and buy some Tesla if they think Tesla's cheap at a given level. With Bitcoin, most of the investors are all in. They don't have the ability to sell something else to reallocate. With more institutional investors coming in, I think you see more of that reallocation between other asset classes. But it also can bring with it some correlation short term.
Interesting.
Of course he's a fan of his own stock.
Yeah, has a glow up there. Can you hear me?
Wi-Fi? Yeah, can you hear me?
Yeah, we're back now. Okay, great.
Okay, we're back.
What do you think of the notion then if these companies just, if even BSTR is scheduled, they think they're going to buy 15,000 more Bitcoin beyond the Bitcoin they're bringing into the fund, 30,000. I mean, that's way more than Bitcoin's being produced every day, every month, et cetera. I mean, at some point, and I know new supply is not the only supply that could be bought, sold, or traded on the market. but it's a lot of buying power.
I think these things are gamble. Like, this is just gambling.
It is gambling. I'm not arguing with you on that. But, right. At some point, do they create enough of a tsunami in the system that they're a part of the tsunami? Not right, but it seems like
continued to outlast all the others.
To outlast bear market at some point and just start to eat into, you know, liquid supply that's available for sale. It'll be interesting to see also how much it is a fad, because I agree with you that it's a trend, but I just don't know if there's a longer lasting arc to this financialization of Bitcoin. There are funds around, ETFs, I think, are here to stay. And are there going to be variations of that where there's competitive advantages around acquiring Bitcoin through the financialization of loans and fiat for as long as fiat's around? Because I do think the dollar's here for a lot longer than people expect. So
the collapse is not necessarily.
Yeah. But let's get into this next topic here on AI. I think we have a clip that we could share.
And so, and the people with bad judgment who don't use AI are dead weight. The people who have bad judgment who do use AI are slop cannons, which I think is a hilarious term that like describes something that we're all beginning to see more and more. The people who have good judgment but don't use AI are steady hands. And the people who have good judgment and use AI are turbo brains. And taking these two together, it's like, okay, like that's happening now. These are the archetypes that are emerging. Somewhere down the road, yeah, it's possible that AI is going to automate away all our jobs. But I also remembered, you know, I'd listened to a podcast, I think, with Dario Amodei, who talked about, you just mentioned this fact, and I went and like researched it. There was about a decade period after the famous chess game where Deep Blue beat Garry Kasparov, where the best chess player in the world was a team of a human and an AI, and that would beat any human or any AI alone. And then, you know, about a decade later, AI beat whatever, what they called the Centaur team. And so I came up with this idea of like this, the Centaur as like really where you want to be, which on Dan Hawk's Matrix is, it's really jumping between, depending on the task, steady hands and turbo brain. I also found this really interesting study from BCG where they gave people access to AI in a bunch of consulting tasks, and then they measured their performance. And the people who did the best by like a large margin were people who used ChatGPT effectively, then the people who didn't use AI, and then the equivalent of the slop cannons who just blindly trusted the AI. And they had this idea of like what's called the jagged frontier of AI gets better at different stuff differentially. And so the people who like get really used to using AI, know what it's good at, know what it's bad at, using it to complement their skills, you know, as sort of like an exoskeleton in the places where it can be a superpower, and then knowing, you know, when not to just trust what might be a hallucination or something where AI is underpowered, like that's really where you want to be. And I don't know how long, like to me, it's very clear we are in the Centaur era of AI now, where the best, like the optimal worker is a combination of human and AI done well, better than a human without AI, better than someone who's, you know, the slop cannon. And I don't know how long it's going to last, but like if you just kind of think about the game theory here, you want to be all in on that. You want.
What do you think?
That's a great clip. I hadn't seen that.
What do you like about that so much? What was it breakdown?
Well, I'm a big Zach fan. Like if you're in Bitcoin and you're not following him, go follow him. He's doing great work as a lawyer in the space. And I think that his analysis of things is generally really well informed. And, but I agree with the sort of spectrum of you have this slop with, you know, AI allows people who maybe shouldn't be able to create exponential content to go ahead and create exponential content. And then, of course, at the opposite end of the spectrum, you have really smart people using AI in a really informed way that are maybe exponentially growing their ability to output work. That number is really, really small, though. There's this dot chart going around on Twitter of, you know, the number of people who are using AI, who've seen AI, who are paying for AI. And it's really, really small. I think something like 86% of people have never used AI. And then the next largest bucket is people who are just using free versions. I have really mixed feelings about this. I mean, I think there's a lot of potential downside. You know, people, a lot of people are really bullish on this, but I think I'm not. I think it's going to break a lot of shit. There's a lot of security problems. It gives the abilities that people shouldn't have to people who shouldn't have them. People have no idea what they're doing. They're like vibe coding. They have no idea how to like architect the product or integrate it like in any idea about any security, anything. There's going to be a lot of carnage. And I don't think people are prepared for the level of that that's coming. What do you think? Are you using AI for anything, Cedric?
Yeah, I'm using the free versions, I guess, to be honest. I'm apprehensive about pouring a lot of time into learning a lot more because I kind of took the Chamath point of view that whatever I learn now will be obsolete by the time I learn it. It's moving so fast. And I also, I'm not sure how much of the tools we end up using are going to be decentralized. I think most things are going to still end up being centralized. Yeah, and I don't think that Bitcoin is going to be the neutral money of AI for the foreseeable future. You could even see stalwarts in the industry are kind of pushing back. I think we should run this clip from Peter Steinberger or of Peter Steinberger on Lex Fridman. But I do think that we might see rapid change and sort of like we've seen in the past where, you know, jobs become obsolete. But I think there'll be opportunities for people to do different things. I think change is hard for people, though. I don't think the people that lose job X are necessarily going to learn the skill to do job Y.
Agreed.
And I don't think that it's going to bring us maybe the efficiency gains that we'd hoped the internet was going to. Everyone thought, you know, with email, you're all your time back. But I think everyone's just expected to do more, to be more productive.
Yeah. And answer now emails 24/7.
Yeah, and get more done with your response. We'll see. But I want to play this clip. Let's play this clip from Peter Steinberger on Lex Fridman.
We comment on the fact that you're increasingly attacked, followed by crypto folks, which I think you mentioned somewhere that means the name change had to be because they were trying to snipe. They're trying to steal. And so you had to be the name. I mean, from an engineering perspective, it's just fascinating. You had to make the name change atomic, make sure it's changed everywhere at once.
Yeah, I failed very hard at that.
You did.
I underestimated those people. It's a very interesting subculture. Everything circles around. I probably get a lot wrong and we probably get hate for that if you say that, but there's like Bags app and then they tokenize everything. And they did the same back with Vibe Tunnel, but to a much smaller degree. It was not that annoying. But on this project they've been swarming me. It's like every half an hour, someone came into Discord and spammed it, and we had to block that. We have like server rules, and one of the rules is no mentioning of butter for obvious reasons, and one was no talk about finance stuff or crypto, because I'm just not interested in that, and this is a space about the project and not about some finance stuff. But yeah, they came in and spammed and annoying. And on Twitter, they would ping me all the time. My notification feed was unusable. I could barely see actual people talking about the stuff because it was like swarms. Mm-hmm. And everybody sent me hashes. And they all try me to claim the fees. Like, we're helping the project, claim the fees. No, actually harming the project. You're like disrupting my work, and I am not interested in any fees. First of all, I'm financially comfortable. Second of all, I don't want to support that because it's so far the worst form of online.
What was the thing that he didn't want spoken about besides crypto? Butter?
I thought that's what he said.
And for obvious reasons, I didn't follow that.
I missed that too.
I kind of admired his vision of sort of excluding everything. Yeah, very hyper-focused. To me, it almost reminded me of Satoshi not wanting to get involved with WikiLeaks and trying to stay focused on building the network. He doesn't care about finance. He said he's financially set, so he's not incentivized to sort of bring external money into this to make money. He's just trying to make this thing as pure and great, I guess, as he can. I don't like when people exclude things and say, I don't care about the money part of it. Like, money is part of everything. So, to me, it's a bit, blinded. But I still admire the laser-like focus. So I didn't really have a problem with it. But I think it demonstrates that the builders of these tools are not interested in decentralized money or really money, really, as part of the protocol yet. That doesn't mean that these things can't be, they're open source. So or some of these things are, so they'll get out. But I don't see the open source things being used as much. I don't think humanity is going to be running their own AI agents the way humanity. I also don't think humanity is going to all self-custody their own Bitcoin on chain.
Yeah, so, I agree.
But that doesn't mean that opportunity is not available to all of humanity. It's just not everyone's going to opt in.
All right.
Let's here's a fun one. Bitcoin's facing its 5-month losing streak. Before we get into that, by the way, this is Bitcoin Center live stream number 42, brought to you by Bite Federal. Go bank yourself. If you're banking yourself on Bitcoin, though, you might have 5 losing months here in a row. But you
is
know,
this the this first is, time?
Not the first time, but the longest in 7 years.
Okay.
And
I see.
About a third of Bitcoin's life now. Doesn't sound as bad. Most of you think about 99% of Bitcoin is sideways or down. But not that many consecutive losing months over this time frame. In 2018, you can see a lot of red. And in 2019, you said a bit of red. And that's where we are in the cycle, I think, in terms of where we are in 2026, historically, and just sort of following the chronological calendar pattern. Not that I think that there's a lot of that or anything. I'm just noting it. So.
I'm unbothered.
You're unbothered?
But I'm unbothered. You could take
right. I mean, it's the low time preference, DCA, HODL. Yeah. But for the people who are trying to figure out maybe where this year is headed, do you think that this is like 2018, 2019, and we have a year or two of a bear market in front of us, regardless of the Adam Becks and the BSTR launching and different things like that? And all the corporate and institutional nation state adoption and mining that's started. I mean, I think those are reasons to be optimistic that there are no longer the cycles of the past, or that we're operating in the same economic environment.
I think the chunks of, you were looking at a chunk of 5 months of red, and I think in the future, whether it's later this year, next year, or even a year or two from now, we're going to see chunks of green. We've talked a lot about Bitcoin's volatility like tampering out. And so perhaps this is the future where it's moving slower. I don't know. I mean, I think there's just reasons to be bullish. I'm, like I said, I'm unbothered. I think all of these, the one thing I will say is like all of these like points that you point to, the reasons that we're bullish, these are like hyper insider pieces of information, not like insider trading, but people that are really in Bitcoin, really following. Normies don't know any of this. They don't care. They still don't understand Bitcoin. I think we've probably like hit the peak number of people that are like coming into Bitcoin primarily because of, you know,
early adopters. We're moving out of the early adoption phase, out of the cypherpunk era, out of the I agree with that. That doesn't mean that I think that normies are hearing more about Bitcoin through the ETFs and
from their financial advisors and the banks and these things.
Right. And I think the rollout, the repeal of SAB 121 and the rollout of SAB 122, banks can custody Bitcoin. You can, more institutions are going to let you collateralize your Bitcoin at places that you feel more comfortable with. I think there's going to be more, I think the Bitcoin interest rate, sort of like to lend against or borrow against your Bitcoin, will come down more towards other assets or other sort of interest rate terms. So, and it'll start acting more like pristine collateral in the system, I think. I think those are real transformative structural events or building. And I think when liquidity finally comes back through money printing, I think that's, the pipes have been sort of built out, I think, way bigger. I do think normies are hearing that 1% to 2%, 5% allocation of Bitcoin is getting normalized. But that doesn't mean
I agree with that.
And so I think that when I'm not saying that we have meteoric sort of go to the moon in the next bull run, but I think that the ground has been laid for more money to flow in, more wealth to come in, more people to allocate towards Bitcoin when maybe not the same kind of retail euphoria comes back, but when the same kind of macro environment comes back and everyone's like, look at Bitcoin, like it's not behaving like the NASDAQ and that's a good thing. And lately it has. It's no longer acting like a risk-on asset and that's a good thing. I think that there's real infrastructure has been built.
Yeah, I agree with you.
So we'll see. All right, well, this has been, we got one more topic. I don't think this is a big deal. Yeah, so the Federal Reserve is reportedly adding another $16 billion into the economy. Looks like they're going to be doing this every month for the foreseeable future. I don't think that these are big numbers. I don't think this is, you know, what turns the corner for Bitcoin, if you will. But it's noted, and we'll see what Powell does maybe in his remaining weeks here. I don't know. Is it? We don't have confirmation that Kevin Warsh is the new Fed chairman
officially.
And I don't think he's officially the nomination yet. I think that's still being floated. I'm not sure. And I don't think he's a Bitcoin bull at all. I think if anything, he wants to tame. No, I think the way he speaks, you know, the Bitcoin price should be tamed by good behavior by the government. They don't print too much money, then Bitcoin price shouldn't run. And so I think it's their way to kind of keep the government in check. I think that's one way to look at it. Maybe, I don't know what the ratio is. Maybe they, you know, does that mean they want to keep it below 200,000, 500,000, a million? Does that mean they want it above a certain point? I have no idea, but his comment so far doesn't make me think that, you know, he's someone who thinks that Bitcoin on the balance sheet is what's going to save the United States government. But I think it's more like Bitcoin is going to keep governments in check.
Which is not something that they would ever be a fan of. So,
no.
Let the games begin.
I think they need to sell. I think they need to sell trust in the system. So, I think the reverse of that is, I think he thinks if Bitcoin price runs, then people feel less trust in the system. So he wants the Bitcoin price not to run.
Okay.
So there is trust in the system.
Gotcha. Okay. Yeah. Well, then there's just another reason to be excited when it does in fact run.
yeah, watch it crumble. Well, I think they'll bend the knee, but we'll see how fast that takes or how slow. It's been another awesome chat, Michelle. I love having you on every
Always
time
great.
You get. Yeah. I don't know if we have any questions in the chat, but this is Bitcoin Center. We do this every Tuesday at 2 p.m. Eastern. Paul Tarantino is usually here, but we love when Michelle's here. And tell us a little bit about Byte Federal.
Yeah, Bite Federal is one of the first Bitcoin ATM companies. We have ATMs in, I think, 44 states. So, you know, if you have cash, you can still use cash to buy Bitcoin, and we are trying to save the cash economy. We have some digital products as well. So, you know, if you need an on-ramp online, we have a new Bite wallet. It's a digital on-ramp, you know, download on your iPhone, on your cell phone, and buy Bitcoin. And we also have a non-custodial wallet, so you can hold your own coin, hold your own keys. You know, so there's a spectrum of options for people depending on where they are in their journey and how much they want to bank themselves. But ultimately, we hope to be able to have a full ecosystem that allows people to go bank themselves entirely and reject the traditional fiat requirements.
Sounds good. Well, thank you for joining us, Michelle. It's always a pleasure.
Thanks for having me, Cedric.
Yeah, we'll see you soon. Be well.
Bye, guys.